We have a few assignments here on the tutorial sheet. I think the first one was taken from the exam 3 years ago, and the second one was taken from the exam either last or the year before. So those are if you ask yourself how large what the scale of these kind of exam assignments are, that is what you could expect. Example as an assignment in an exam. The other one, the 9.3 with the prototype-based design, is more of a free programming thing that doesn't have anything. Well, it's considering that it's a three-liner on the assignment sheet, that is clearly not enough for getting the right constraints to actually know what you have to do in an exam. So that is a non-typical thing in an exam. So that would be unusual to have. Just as a kind of orientation thing, because I know you're all interested in these exam question things, and I've forgotten to put on that tutorial sheet that there are actually a few old exam questions on there. Good. Apart from that, let's dive right into this one, delegation and prototypes. This is an assignment that is about simulating the concepts of one language in another, or kind of emulating, or even in this case, it is a part of an interpreter of, in this case, Lua code written in Java. So that is one of these typical things that you have seen in other tutorial sheets also, where we try to provide the services for one concept within another language, which is kind of this compiler approach to these kind of things. So in our cases, we want to have a Lua interpreter in Java. And in order to not have to reinvent the wheel completely, we are given a few basic concepts in the face of form of interfaces, so that we don't have to care about the actual implementations, but we know what we can work with in our settings. So there's two basic things to work with for us in Lua, and the first thing is an interface for these tables. And, well, how can you interact with tables? You can do a get and a put on it, kind of pretty similar to what hash tables support. So you can get a value if you provide the right key, and you can put a value under a certain key by giving it to the method. So far nothing too spectacular. It's just kind of giving the interface of what one of these tables can do. And then there's always this special thing of having meta tables. For our purposes, we only have a get meta table here. Of course, there would be something like a set meta table also in a real interpreter, but for the purposes of not confusing and not providing too much clutter on here, it's just a get meta table in here. And as we have all heard in the lecture, a meta table is just an ordinary table used in a special way. So there's nothing too complicated, hopefully, about that. Then there's another interface of another basic language entity of Lua, and that is, in this case, the closure, which is, well, just kind of a handle to a function. So what can you do with something like that? For our purposes, what we can do is we can execute such a method given by such a closure, and, well, if you execute something like that, you are probably, at some points you will get parameters, at some points you won't get any parameters, and you're not sure about the actual amount of parameters, and that's why we have this kind of variadic argument construct here, well, we can just put an arbitrary number of parameters into that call. So that is how the closure is modeled for our purpose here. Of course, there might be a lot of other things around with closures, but it's not so interesting for us here. Thus, we only have these few modeling things. So, in general, those interpreters get some way of accessing source code. In our case, the interpreter works on not pure program text, but on the program's syntax tree already, so we don't need to parse it anymore. Instead, all that we need to do is somehow treat syntax tree elements. And what our purpose is here for that specific assignment is to provide a method evaluate, which is there to somehow compute things that are intended to run by the program. And for our purpose, what we need to evaluate a table for a certain key. That is what this thing kind of implies. And yeah, it evaluates a Lewis sub-expression of the form of table.key. Well, just to make it very, very clear, it just says it once again in plain text, and also even gives an example of Lua code where such an expression actually occurs, and it's even in a way that it's very prominent. It's just that thing that you need to provide, nothing else. So it's just the pure lookup process and the process of actually returning whatever you find there is what you need to do here. So give an implementation for that thing is our job. I think that's the whole art of the whole of this whole assignment. It looks pretty longish, but it's just a very small thing that you actually have to do. Otherwise, it wouldn't be suitable for something like an exam. Okay, I think that's all for that purpose. So maybe let's let the screen stay on table and closure, and yeah, concentrate on actual implementation. What's here? Oh, yeah, it's the wrong screen. This screen. So, for the it's not Lua code that we have to provide. It's actual Java code that we have to write. So, let's do that. We need to provide some way of framing what we want to do, so let's just create class frame so that we have something where we can put our method into, but that is not necessarily part of the thing. So what we actually need to provide is, well, is it it's, I have to select that a static object eval. And it's going to have to be tables and strings. Why is it strings for key? Or why is it a string for key? Well, usually it's to do with this syntactic sugar thing that we have talked about, where we have this syntax where you do something like for a table, you do this kind of axis, and that is translated internally into something like table lookup key. Remember, it's all about these very basic facilities that we have. We only do lookups on tables, and we can use or all the attribute names that we use here are just translated into the plain string representation. So that's why we have the key as a string over here. So good. So let's have a look at what we have to work with. On tables, we can just do a plain get. So that would be probably the first thing to try. So whatever we return from there is whatever we plan to return is maybe hidden in the table. So what we do is we try to get what is in there. And return that at some point. Yeah, that would be the ideal case, when we directly have a key registered in the actual table and have a value in there. We can just query the table for the value and return. Is that all that happens in evaluating tables? Maybe think about corner cases. What if the get returns no value, a nil, or a null? Yeah.
We have to ask the metatable and look up the function __ index.
So we somehow need to think about metatables. Exactly. Metatables is something we get here by just asking get metatable. So we obtain that by table get metatable, something like that. Is it small cases? No, it's camel case, so like that. For that we can get metatable. But of course, well, the thing is, if red, the return value is actually a value, so if it is not null, we can return it already there in the short path, so we don't have to actually do that. Then we have to ask for whether there is a meta table. Reading through that, we already get the first hint that that might be null if there's no meta table. Okay, what do we have to make out of that? Oh, that is not what we wanted. This one. So, what is... Go away. What is the thing if the meta table is actually non-existent for that thing, if there is no meta table registered for that table?
Then we return null.
So let's maybe just do another check. If meta is not... Well, if meta is null in that case, we return null. Well, in principle, we would have to return that nil thing. I haven't specified in that assignment how nil is actually represented. At that point, you can decide whether you model it with a null or whether you somehow provide a dummy nil thing. It doesn't matter too much here, as long as you just do something that indicates what the actual idea of that would be. For example, that would suffice, but you could also kind of create a unique constant nil that you would put somewhere in your code area and return that thing as a singleton. I'm completely fine with that. So it's not so so fixed. That is a theme that is with many of the exam based things. It always looks like there is one solution, but it's actually not. As there might be variations in there, and even give me something with which I can work as a person who has to correct these things. In case that I actually find your approach worthwhile, I might credit you points for that. So don't stop if it's completely unclear to you, but just take a few assumptions. If they are too far-fetched, those assumptions, well, it might not yield any points for you, but at least you have tried to get pros, and you might be rewarded for that thing. So in case you get stuck, tell me about what you get stuck and do an assumption and continue. So yeah, that would be a strategy for that kind of assignments. Well, anyway, in case it is not null, then we know that matter is for sure existing. So I don't remember, was it you who answered with the meta table what we did? So then the next steps were already somehow sketched. We somehow have to ask Meta for advice what to do here. And the key thing is now not to delegate the lookup to Meta, but to ask Meta for where to delegate to. So that is kind of the thing that I wanted to see in there. So, yeah, what do I actually ask Meta for? And
get the underscore index value.
So it is a constant that I'm asking for, and it is exactly the constant underscore underscore index. So that would be the thing to go for. And I can store it in somewhere. And that's another case of whether the get. Oh, that was my finger. Sorry. There's another case of checking once again for null whether there is an entry or not. So there's a lot of spaghetti code and delegation target. If that is also null, then there is no delegation target, and once again I return null or my nil singleton or whatever you have come up with. Now I've assured that my delegation target is not null. How do I react to that situation?
Delegation target and my key.
Maybe also catch the return of that, but yeah. Okay. That's fine for you? Is it covering all the cases that we have? Looks fine for the first try. However, remember that part here that we are giving also an interface for something like that. Didn't need that up until now. So that might also already be a hint that there might be some functions or closures or whatever to think about in that assignment.
Okay, I can only assume that the underscore index thingy is a table or null.
Is a table? No. Exactly. It also might be a function. Remember, you can customize the delegation process with a function. So, maybe that assumption that the delegation target is a table might be a little bit too strong. So, let's do something about that. And that would mean that we, first of all, just assume that that's an object. I just call it index because why not? And now we have to somehow, first of all, that thing maybe is not depending on whether it's a table or not, that is already a thing that we can assure on the index if it's still an object. So it doesn't matter whether what the type is. If it is null, then our answer will be null. So now we should probably disambiguate between the two cases, whatever our index might be. So it's once again spaghetti. If index instance of table, then, of course, we can use the delegation target. Then that's table of index. And we can just evaluate that on here. Okay? Then we could either dare to use else or do another if index instance of, in our case, a closure. That is our function thing. And for that, that would be the delegation function is a closure. Oh, this verbose Java code is always nice. And now I have my closure here. What do I need to do with that? So you say eval.
I thought the closure object has a function.
Let's have a look. How that looks like.
Execute.
Mm-hmm. No reason to be sorry. Okay. It's all with these second screens and all these things. It's not so easy. Okay, so you wanna have the delegation function. Like that, and you want to do an exec on this one. And this one needs two parameters. We can give arbitrary parameters to that, and we also get a return value. And remember how these callbacks work. You get For index, the convention is that you have a callback in the situation of the table and the key and not being able to resolve that key in that table. So we get table and key as the parameters here, and that's what we should give to the exec function here, because it's assumed that closure is actually able to interpret those two parameters. Otherwise, it would not be suitable to be registered there. So we need to provide the table on which the lookup failed, as well as the key. What do we do with the return value? What is it supposed to return? That is maybe the major question here. Yeah, and well, in that case, it's just about maybe either give a table that is responsible for resolving, or give the actual value that the whole thing will resolve to. So that might be two viable options here. And yeah, giving back a table for a resolution would require some other code to run, and we haven't heard about something like that in the slides. And it's actually a return value. So the callback is supposed to already do the resolution and provide the desired value, which needs to be looked up as return value. So we can catch it here in our eval function, and in the end finally return it. Okay. That would be it. Yeah?
Wouldn't it be kind of bad if we try to look up in the table we get from the exec on the closure, because then maybe if you want to return the table, you kind of look into a table we were supposed to just return?
Yeah, it's not the way that the protocol is intended to work, so it's a bad idea to do that, of course. Yeah, but it was just theoretical what could be done here, but it makes more sense to just have the answer to the lookup. So it's not quite the five liner that I promised, but we're quite verbose in our solution. But anyway, it's quite a short piece of code, and it's more about, well, that thing is probably summing up how the complete delegation process actually works in terms of some, well, not pseudocode, but something that you're supposed to be able to program yourself. So that was kind of the idea behind that assignment, to be able to specify in some meaningful way what happens in delegation. So do you find that difficult, or was it okay? Well, I got very mixed results in that one. So it's just specifying, not with free wording, but with a fixed set of API, what happens in case of a delegation. That is what you need to be able to do in that case. Yeah. So, is there any questions on that one? Maybe in terms of how would something like that be corrected afterwards? Well, it's a very nice example of having this getting points for making additional steps in there. Just the plain lookup is only a very basic set of points. Actually, knowing that there is a meta table that you have to query next points, you have to interpret the meta table as maybe the delegation table, another set of points, and remembering that there is also the possibility of a delegation function in there, last set of points. So that is kind of a quite modular way of thing. I don't know how you feel about that. I hope you like that kind of assignments. So, next one. That was also an exam question, and that was kind of marrying traits and delegation. That is something that I haven't talked about in the lecture, but with this Lua way of just having maps, this is quite close to the calculus things that we have done in the mix-ins and trade-ins lecture anyway, because all the basic entities in there are actual maps. So all the things that we have defined in the mix-in and trades lecture can somehow be directly implemented with the maps that we get from a prototype-based language like Lua. So it's pretty well suited for combining those two. So in our case here, we have the idea of implementing traits in Lua. And in order to make it more simple for you, we conveniently can see how the trait composition with the symmetric join is actually implemented. So you don't have to look that up on your cheat sheet. That is the or should be the same thing as you have on the slides anyway. I guess it hasn't changed that much from that point. I think it's just the thing that we're talking about maps all the time. That is maybe the wording coming from the Lua part, and that would directly translate to the tables from the maps come from the trade part, and that would directly translate to Lua's tables. So good. Then, in order to remind you of how code actually looks like in Lua and what typical syntax elements in Lua are, there is a short example of how asymmetric dispatch function looks like in Lua. So with that, you implicitly have a kind of a thing where we can orient yourself on how Lua code actually looks like and what the typical things were in there. And you might reuse parts of that in actual the solving the assignment. So what we see here is the asymmetric dispatch in contrast to the symmetric one that we are given in this mathematical part. So that is not the implementation of the thing up there, but the implementation for the asymmetric join. And you see it working on a receiver, that is the one who has to dispatch, with a key that already looks quite a lot like the dispatching function that we have seen in the assignment before, that can be used for these underscore index things. So yeah, that might be some hint of where you could use that. So there's a receiver part, a receiver parameter, and a key parameter. And what it does is this local thing. I think we haven't talked about too much, but that is a way of having local variables. That was not so important for us at that point, but here we see that exists. And what we do is we do receiver.m1. This m1 is talked about here, and that seems to be some maps on which to dispatch in asymmetric fashion with the key as parameter, as a lookup. So what is done here is in the receivers m1 we look up k. if there is not a valid answer from that, what we do is we return receiver.m2 lookup k. As the whole thing is supposed to do asymmetric dispatch, and considering that we have a lookup of m1, and only if that one turns out not to be usable, then we dispatch to the second one. Well, that is how you could do such an asymmetric dispatch. Our task here is now to implement a counterpart in the symmetric world, which would be the symmetric dispatch that implements dispatching of key k based on the symmetric join. The rest remains the same. There's still the other two maps on which to perform the composition, M1 and M2. But in our case, we need the symmetric version. So, let's do that. So, Lua code, we start with function whenever we want to provide a function, and we have to end it. Then we are supposed to write a specific function, specifically the asymmetric dispatch with a receiver and a key. The symmetric one. That is just... Well, you see, you can work with the things that you have gotten there. You have some kind of clue on how to program Lua already on the tutorial sheet. So that's the symmetric dispatch with the receiver and the key. Let's call it key even. And yeah, how do we do that? For the asymmetric one, we have first of all obtained a value from M1, and only if that turned out to be unusable, we turn to M2. For our purposes, we probably have to consider both of them in some kind of way. So let's maybe get two locals, U1. And obtain that from receiver.m1 and the key. Where's end gone? Seems that my syntax highlighting is not working the way that I wanted it, but well. We can do without for a short amount of time. Oh, bugger. Okay, so those are our two values, and we have to compose them in their least upper bound way. That is what we get to see in the mathematical part over there. So, we have to check for whether those things are undefined. Well, we can try to borrow from here. There's this if not, and then the value syntax from here. So let's maybe do it the same way. If not V1, how do we continue with if things? There's a then, okay. Then, yeah, if V1 is not provided, well, we can directly return has, you see, the other one is then meant to be. So return V2. And yeah, that's what you can read here. You have to end with end. Same for the other side. So if V2 is not present, then return V1. Good. What else are the cases here? This one here. If P1 is the same as P2, then we answer with either of them. So, if P1 is V2, then return V1 or whatever. Doesn't matter. Yeah, what do we answer now? Top, otherwise. Yeah, what do you propose? How do we actually differentiate between nil as an answer and in conflict? And that is the key thing in the in that assignment. So, in this part here, you have two symbols. You have a bottom and a top. Using the same value as an answer for both of them will confuse the whole system, as you cannot differentiate between them anymore, and your whole comparison and the ordering gets messed up. So that's not what you can do here. So we need to somehow differentiate here, and my proposition would be to just introduce a random singleton thing, like this top, and we can check for equivalence with that top thing. In principle, we could also introduce a bottom symbol, but that would need us to rewrite that thing into whether V1 is bot or V2 is bot. We could do that, but it's sufficient to assume that bottom is nil. Yeah?
Isn't this way top equals bottom, and then it doesn't matter anymore?
The question is whether comparison is done by a reference or by structural equality. And in our case, I would, at least as I've as far as I know, it is done by reference. But who? Yeah, of course. Yeah, that is a thing that you need to consider. So anyway, with that thing. Have you checked?
Yeah.
And it's reference, yeah. That is what I would have expected. But that was a guess. Anyway, with that thing, you won't run into problems. Because nil is different from this top thing. So that would be a solution for the whole thing. It's also, well, it's not a five-liner, but it's also quite short. You wanted to ask something?
Just want to add, you shouldn't use nil as well as bottom, because then it's equivalent.
Yeah. Definitely. It needs to be differentiated, otherwise you can't have the semantics that the original function had. Okay. Questions on this one? No? Completely satisfied with that. There's another example of how exam-style questions turn out to be. It's not too much code that you have to provide, and at least I try to give you as much material to work with already on the sheets. So you, in this case, you see, you didn't need, need to learn by heart the way that symmetric or asymmetric joins actually worked. You also got a kind of a template for how code in Lua looks like, because I assume that if you would just start from scratch with Lua code, well, probably also me, I would fail. So with that, you get at least in the mood of writing that, and if you do small syntax errors in your own Lua code, well, then it's a small syntax error. It's more about being able to tell us to somehow define what you want to do, and with the small syntax errors, they don't count as very very large deductions or something. So don't be afraid of that kind of thing. I'll try to give you something with which you can work, and the small syntax errors are not the ones that I'm after. So as long as it's clear what it's going to be in the end, and I try to read something into the things that you provide me with, as long as you provide me with something, it shouldn't be too bad for you. Okay, so maybe next assignment, if you don't have any questions on this one anymore. Okay, good. So that is that now is not an exam style assignment. It's more about playing with Lua, so to get a little bit of a feeling what means you have for working with problems. So, prototype-based design, it's all about. So it's a little bit about working with Lua and trying to use the Lua features for its best.
Could we first do the second part of the last?
Oh, sorry. That's also a common thing in exams that people forget about the second parts. Okay, so use this function to implement a function compose traits, which takes a pair of trait maps as inputs. A pair of trait maps that need to be composed. Well, that already sounds like that thing here, the M1 and M2. They need to somehow come from somewhere. Takes a pair of trait maps as inputs and creates an object-like map as output. So quite similar to what we have seen with this new function on the slide. That delegates its lookups to the traits in symmetric join fashion. Yeah, so we need to configure the delegation process in there. How to configure delegation process is something that we have learned. It's about providing a function with this __ index entry in the meta table. As long as you know about that, you know how this delegation works. You can also put, of course, a direct delegation target in there, but that's the boring part. That's the one which is, yeah, you can't configure too much about that because it's just giving the target. If you want to do something special, you need to register a function there. And remember what we've done in the first part of the assignment. We have written a dispatching function for the asymmetric join. So that might be reusable for the second part. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to reuse the symmetric dispatch function as the delegation function in our compose traits function. So the function compose traits, I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah. And it needs to run on given traits. given as tables. What it needs to return at some point is something that acts like an object. So let's maybe create something like that. So far it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do shit. So let's work with that thing a little bit more. We need to configure how this thing performs resolving of things that it cannot resolve locally. That's how these, whenever you have composed these traits, are going to be used. They are assembled in object-like facilities, and for everything that is not overwritten in this class things, it delegates to the traits. Okay, so we should configure the meta table for that with an appropriate meta table. The only thing that this meta table needs to provide is actually an entry for index, at least at the moment. So we could either create a new table over here that we call meta and then put in there, or we can directly just open that in an anonymous fashion like that and do this inline declaration of the table, and in there we can provide key value pairs. And remember, in order to configure a delegation process, we need to provide an entry in the underscore underscore index. So that's the key. Now we need the value. What would be the appropriate value to put in there? Well, we already kind of have something like this symmetric dispatch thing already that looks up in a table. Well, it's called when what it does is it looks up in a table for an M1 thing under the key. We could try to make use of that, but we need to make sure that within the table that is put here, we actually find an M1 and an M2. So let's do that. What's going to be ending up here as parameter will be the O thing, because we configure the index function for in the meta table for this O object. So let's put trait 1 in there as the entry for M1 and bind M2 to trait 2. When we do that, we have established that we can look up M1 and M2 in O. So whenever the O directly cannot answer to a certain lookup, we will get its index delegation method called. And if we put just symmetric dispatch in there, oh, that's the version. I don't know how that ended up in the memory, but yeah. If we put the symmetric dispatch function in there, we get that code to run, and that will run with in the context that lookup has failed on O, and the failed table will go in there as receiver, And the failed key, of course, yeah, we can't see it here, but this will go in there. Running the symmetric dispatch now will issue a lookup on M1. And considering that receiver is bound to O, what M1 will bind to is trait 1. So we will perform the lookup on trait 1 instead of O. And in parallel, we will also perform the lookup on trait 2, because that is bound to M2. We will perform the join, as we have seen it in the definition, and return the result for that. Okay. That would be the idea. I think it's not perfect, because the top is something that there's a little bit flying around in that solution, and will lead to that will cascade up to other areas where we actually perform calls on things that are in conflict with these traits, and that will lead to an empty table being there and answering all the lookups that are performed on that thing. And but that's the way that Lua does all the way. So if you, for example, return nil at a certain point, that also cascades up to some other point. So that's kind of given by the way that Lua works. But it's as close as it can be to something like traits. At least with the amount of work that we want to put in an exam. Good. This time it's actually a 5-liner. Good. Questions on this one? Yeah.
I mean, the implementation is quite easy. But the explanation of the assignment was a little bit confusing for me. I didn't understand the pair of trait maps, but I think somehow I understand it in the implementation now. So the assignment was a little bit confusing for me.
Ah, okay. This function to implement a function compose traits, which takes a pair of trait maps as I should have written as parameters instead of as input, and returns an object like map, maybe, or an object like table would have been better.
Yeah, that's the kind which confused me somehow.
That's not a good wording here. I try to work on that.
Okay. Maybe some kind of keyword new in the object like map context.
You mean directly as a name for this one?
No, more like a new map as return value.
But that's kind of the exercise, you know.
But I see your point. What you mean? What do you want to say with that? It's always working on these lengthy text things that is the tricky part about getting these things right. Well, the thing is that. Although I'm not a big supporter of questions during an exam, the thing is that we are in one room. So there's no need for synchronization between different rooms, and in case that those questions about understanding these things pile up, we can just at some point have an announcement of clarifying things. So it's, still, I need to see the point in what you're actually confused about. So I won't try to disturb everybody with just a thing that I will consider as, not so helpful for the majority. But in case that something really needs clearing up, and I understand what you mean here, I think I'm going to refine a little bit. But I hope at least when working on these texts that I get a lot of the confusion out of that. So, good. Questions on that? No? Okay. So we can start with playing a little bit with Lua now. Yeah, and that is one of the typical things that, or the typical settings that you always get when you talk to compiler people. Compiler people really like expression trees and arithmetical expressions as their running example. Maybe if you had the theoretical computer science here, that is also one of the beloved examples on what to parse and whether you are able to have a stack machine that accepts those kind of expressions and all that. And yeah, so it's a very recurring thing here. And once again, that is happening here too. So the idea is about representing arithmetical expressions in a computer language, in the sense that you are very flexible in creating all possible expressions in some kind of data structure in memory, and have the opportunity of having as well constants in there and variables, build up an expression tree, and then in the next phase evaluate this expression tree for different bindings of the variables, in the sense that you can configure how those variables should evaluate to, and then hit start and let the expression be evaluated with the context variable A maps to 5 and variable B maps to 42 or something. So that is a usual task that you get in this compiler bow thing, compiler construction thing. So it's pretty near to what a syntax tree actually is. And that's why people like to do this. It's a very simplified version of a syntax tree. And yeah, the idea is, what can a language like Lua give us for that sense? And I've already had on the slides the idea of programming with Lua would be to just kind of start from what you would like the as facilities, and then just fill in all the blanks that you need for the whole thing to work. So what I would like to have would be to be able to represent expression trees in memory and give them a reference or a name, like this one here, would be an expression tree. And I would like to use things like constants in there. We've had 5. Add them to another constant, like 42, but multiply that with some kind of variable that we call, for example, B or X or whatever. That would be the idea that I would really fancy to have my expression trees to be defined. That is pretty near to what we would use to express an expression on the on paper of just mathematical means. And it's a very short way of doing that. There's no not a lot of fuss around with creating new object and all that. It's just like you would write the whole thing as an expression. What you would like... Oh, cursor. What I would like to do with that is also very specific. I would like to evaluate that thing. And I would like to evaluate that with the context that X binds to some specific value. And I would like to re-evaluate the whole thing also in another context. So that is things that I would like to work with our representation. And yeah, that is something that should be in the end evaluated and printable and should give us a specific number. Difficult or unusual to this level?
The idea is understandable, but I have no idea how to implement it in Lua.
Mm-hmm. That's why that is not an exam. Yeah, I can completely understand that. It's about just getting used a little bit into design. So if you're just interested in the exam things, I think that's the part where to leave the room. It's more about somehow getting the flow of what you can do with these things. So, yeah, it's just for interested people, so to say. But, yeah, if you want to know how to do something like that, then just try to come up with something. So, one thing would be that in order to support something like this eval, it would be good to kind of have a facility which is quite suited for performing this evaluation things. And with the context of this compiler construction, what we know that having these trees composed of all the elements that are in there is a usual way to do that, with storing operators and operands in as the children of a certain node, and that one of these nodes is just a simple expression in the sense that it is either a unary expression or a binary expression, and we can work the whole expression bottom up in the sense that we start from either constants or variables. For variables, we know from the parameter table here how to bind those things. So these carry just numeric values. And for the more complex expressions, we know that all we have to deal with is binary expressions. And we assume that if we work from the bottom, we know concrete values for the leaves. And for such a binary expression, we can just take those two values and we know how the operator is. So on that, we can, by divide and conquer, just perform the computation and obtain a new value that we can use in the dominating expression and thus propagate the values up from the leaves to the root of the whole thing. So that is why this type of representation is quite suitable. The question is now, how do I get that kind of thing in a form where it creates such a tree? And the magic is, well, we have these operators over here, which quite look like... look like arithmetic operators, but remember what we have talked about in the on the slides. We can do something compared to the C++ operator overloading. And instead of performing a concrete addition here, what we can instead do is create an expression that obtains as its operator child a symbolic representation of plus, or even the evaluation function for plus, and as two children, well, the left part and the right part. And if we define all the operators that we use between the operands in there in such a way, we can build up the whole tree. And the only thing that we depend on is that those things that I have so leisurely just put there, this const 5 and this var x, create appropriate nodes that we can use as leaves. And if all of them are kind of tables for which the operators are overwritten in the same way, we can then make the composed table be with the same delegation, and thus we can build up such a tree. So, to make things short, what we need to do is we need to first of all come up with a bunch of a table that has the operators overloaded in the way that we want them to be overloaded, and what we want them to do is to create a certain type of objects. So we need to I would choose Explorer as our reference or handle to this type of things, because all those things are sub-expressions from each other, so expression would be an appropriate name for that thing. So it's, first of all, it's just an empty table, and we want to use that as carrier as a meta table that carries all the overloaded things. So no need to have this twofold indirection. We will just use the expression thing itself as carrier for these overloaded things. So just put it in there. That is something that you have seen quite a lot of times in these Lua things here. You could separate them, but that just means that you have to think of a new name that will only be used once. So yeah. Good. We want to create a lot of different tables that delegate to these kind of overloaded versions of the operators. So we need some facility to create more of them, and that's something that we do with these new kind of things. So that is usually what we. Oh, horrible. That is what we actually want to do here. And these things are meant to set their meta tables for whatever we use there. It's once again these object kind of things to Expert. And sorry, I have the colon version, so self is the thing that we want to use, and we will return the O here. You look like you have a question.
Yeah, I don't understand why you use widgets and not.
Why I use what?
The function, it's Lua, right? So you have no.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
And according to Stack Overflow, you might try meta x and then Lua dash mode to activate Lua mode.
Yeah, it's not installed.
Okay.
On my desktop I have installed, so yeah. But okay. It seems that on the presentation machine I don't have it. But thank you anyway. So that now enables us to establish that for arbitrary tables we can just put our Expert thing as delegation target, and thus we can use expert to carry the overloaded versions of the operators. So we could do something like provide an expert dot underscore add to get a callback whenever a plus is used with these kind of things, and it gets two parameters or two operands, A and B, and what I would do is, well, we need to somehow represent them in form of a table at that point. So how that can be achieved would be, of course we want to have them in table form. Like that. But we want to have tables that are delegating their add operators and multiplication operators to our expert versions. So we can do that by using this expert new thing on that. That would register expert as delegation target. Now the question is, what do we put in there? And we want to have tables that carry the left operand, the right operand, and the operation somehow with them. So let's just do that. Left, we bind to A. Right, we bind to B. And then we somehow need to bind the operand. And what could we actually do there? We could now come up with some symbolic representation for, in this case, the addition, and later on try to match what we find in our binary expression with that kind of thing. Or we can even remember that functions are first-class citizens in that language. So we can even just put a closure in there, which we can just apply to two numbers that we have computed for the left operand and the right operand. So why not do that? That would be something like that, and it needs to return something, and I would say let's return A plus B. So it's a very it's code that we provide here as value for the operand, and it's just the how to interpret that particular situation. It's quite tricky, and you might have to think a little bit about that. But that would be the way to represent that. Because afterwards, when we do the actual evaluation, all we need to do is to check whether we have a binary expression, meaning an expression that has a left and a right key. And if so, we just say obtain whatever is an operand and apply it to left and right. And we can do so for all of the binary expressions without actually caring what they are or what specific operand it was that actually connected them. We can just use the operation. So operand was something like that might be the better thing. So sorry, that was me brain farting. Yeah. So you can continue to do so with all the others. I think multiplication is one of them. And it would do something pretty similar. But just instead of that, we would do that. And you can imagine you can continue to do so for all the other operators that you want to support in that. That gives you how to react to having these operators in there, but we still need to think about what we actually have to do whenever we have this the constant and the var thing. I already pre-hinted to you, or gave hints to you how you can act here, because I already have used this syntax of having these kind of constructor-like expressions in there that already give you function names with which you can react to them being there. The only thing that you need to do now is to actually tell about what const, I think it's integer that we use here, to tell about the system what you do in case that user has used const as a special name. So what we need here is to return something that opens up this expression tree world for us. It needs to somehow connect the number that is given as a parameter to some expression. And we need to return a complex type here. Once again, we should probably pipe it through this expression constructor. And in our case, what this expression needs to retain is some idea about what constant we assigned to that thing. For example, someone needs to remember that this has been the constant 5. So, well, of course, we need the curly brackets for the table. And we need to somehow remember what I is. The question is now, under which key do we do that? You can choose an arbitrary key as long as it doesn't interfere with these ones. Why is that? Well, we see that afterwards in the implementation of the eval, but I will use the key names that are present in these tables as a way to differentiate between what actual expression we had at that point. That's why I need different names here, but yeah. So I will actually use const as the key name here. And in a pretty similar fashion, I would have to react to a variable name. In this case, it's a character, or not a character, even a string. Doesn't matter what name, it's just to illustrate that that will be a string afterwards, but don't have to bother with types in this setting. So I will use expression new. With var name is this string, and be done with that. So if we do something like that, then creating a const and a var will actually give us tables for which the delegation goes to all the things that we have defined for expr, which means that in case those expr-based tables will take part in an addition or a multiplication, it will then yield the creation of new expressions with of this form here, with the left and the right parameters. Okay? So that will kind of step by step create a whole tree of tables that are in the leaves carrying only one attribute, only one key value binding. Either const is an integer or var name is a string. Or if they are intermediate nodes, they will be tables that have a left and a right, and an operator that is actually telling you about how that thing evaluates in case that you already have an evaluation for their children. So the only thing that remains for the eval that we want to use here in order to actually compute the result for the whole thing would be to go collect all the examples, all the values from the leaves and put them into their parent expressions, because they already carry with them the information of how they connect to each other. So you put them in there, utilize your operator on them, obtain a new value and give it to the parent. It's just a kind of a depth first run. Once again, depth first search, most important thing for these compiler people. Just use a depth first search in your eval, and if you run into a leaf, then return the associated value. And if you run into if you run into a constant, also a value. If you run into a complex type, then just apply your operator on those things. So how can we do that? Well, let's see how an expression evaluates. We can have a binding in an an environment like this. That is just a mapping that carries bindings of the form x goes to 4711 or 42 or whatever, and could even carry several of these bindings. Doesn't matter. We can use several variables in there, and as that is an ordinary Lua binding, I can choose as many key value pairs as I want in there. So it's just misusing that the whole thing is a map anyway. So yeah, good. If self dot constant is present, that indicates that the expression that we are working on has a const key with an appropriate value, then we will just return it. That's for sure. Then self dot var name exists, then in our case it's not the value that is entered in a variable, but it is a name of the variable that is entered in there. The place where to look up for the correct binding for that variable is the environment. So in that case, what we need to do is we need to check for we need to check our environment for the variable name. So we evaluate what the variable name actually is from self and look it up in environment. Yeah. So these are the two leaf cases. Now the question is, what do I do with everything else? Well, everything else will have been created via one of these operator overloaded things. So I can assume that there is a left and there's a right. To make it productive code, I should actually check. But I don't care, because it's just a tutorial. So I can, what can I do here? I do a return of the operator application, because I know that this is a binary expression, I know that there will be an operator in there. I have registered them myself, and I can apply them to operand left and operand right. But so something like this, and of course with self and self. Right? Well, at least theoretically, because there's still one thing. Left and right are actually not numbers, but they are tables. And what we need for these operators to work on is actual numbers. How do we get numbers for our operands? Well, that is exactly what the evil function does. So what we need to do is we need to recursively call the evil function on left and right with the appropriate environment. So on that, we need to call evil with env that will descend into the left subtree and perform evil there. Descend, descend, descend until it at some point reaches a constant or a var name, where it will just return an appropriate value. That would be an integer. So that will yield an integer for the left part, and for the right part we need to do the same. Yeah, now we've got two numbers. Numbers can go into our operation or the operator. This will yield another number, which in the end will yield a simple number that we can just print. And we can reuse this tree no matter what environment we will come up later on. It's just, yeah. We'll just do the lookups in that line here differently to the run before. Yeah. Of course, you would directly come up with something like that. Clear? But no. It's just to show you what you can do with these kind of constructs, to how to creatively work with them. And it's trying to use, well, delegation is not so much an issue here. Well, it happens over here where you do the set meta table thing and register your operand overloaded your overloaded versions of your operators. But it's not a real delegation centered approach. It's just a little bit about operator overloading. I think if you're more into C++ programming, you would have been able to come up with a quite similar approach to modeling these expression trees in C++. It's almost directly applicable to the C++ operator overloading. So, yeah. That's probably also, well, if you have something like this C++ operator overloading in mind, you already know what you would like to do and can just use the Lua facilities to do that. And since there are quite nice features as having these closures in there and having these configurable callbacks for the operands, you can quite easily do that. Yeah. Questions? So just remember that's just for show here. That was clearly not a thing that you should be able to program by yourself from the beginning. It's just to get a little bit of a feeling of what these very simple mechanisms can give to you, and yeah, maybe get a little bit of an idea of how to write your code in such a situation, and how you could benefit from constructs like these if you find them in your language of choice.
So, how does the eval map the actual plus sign to the add method by function?
Doesn't need to, because the mapping already happens here. Here's the place where you run into all these const and var expressions, and those already create tables that delegate to expert for everything that they cannot resolve. And so you can imagine that this thing over here, this const thing, is already replaced by a table that delegates to expr. Mm-hmm. Same for constant over here, that also creates such a thing. So if they happen to encounter a plus symbol in there, there's need for the interpreter to do something about that, because plus is originally only defined for numbers. But if they happen to be tables on the left and on the right, mm-hmm. it will either bail out and say not defined, or check for a metatable entry in, I think in this case it's the left most operand, and look for an entry called underscore underscore add in case of addition. So and that's when the system dispatches to this part here, where you just return another expression table, or another table that dispatches to expr. So if you have passed that point, you don't have any plus symbols anymore, but you just have an expression table that has left and right keys to other expressions until it reaches the tables that are meant to be leaves. And on that that level here, you only need to run through the already assembled tree, which will just end up in having all the operators of the tree being called after eval has been called on the respective subtrees. Yeah, it does a depth first run on there, which will terminate in constants and variables and yield values or lookup values, and with that we'll just compute. Mm-hmm. So you repeat the computations you specify here times after times after. The only thing that I have conveniently left away is, of course, operator precedence isn't carried out with these things. I would have needed to put brackets around that to make the multiplication the to make it unambiguously interpretable as multiplication is meant to be done before I do the addition. So
is that included in the language, that he prefers brackets before no brackets? Or would we have to take care of that as well?
No, that's just simple expression evaluation here. That it would be the same as in the multiplication. I don't know whether the multiplication would even have precedence in the presence of tables instead of of numbers. Maybe it will. I don't know. But to make it unambiguous, I would just use the brackets. Yeah, it's a completely different topic, and I actually don't know how they handle precedence. Maybe precedence stays as it is in arithmetic expressions. I haven't looked into that. It was just about showing you how to use these operator overloadings and this recursive eval then. Yeah. Still, anything? Okay. So then, that's it for today. The last thing is more of a tedious job to do for people who really like to work with Lua a little bit, because it needs you to look up things about having arbitrary many parameters and how to actually handle them. And I think it's just about having to look up a little bit of syntax in there and API calls, and that's not so interesting. It's just something that I have, I think, on my slide somewhere, that you can do these multiple inheritance on arbitrary many parents, but it doesn't give you any new parts. So yeah, it's just optional, and if you really like Lua and like to do this thing, you can have a look at that. But I think by now I have had enough exam assignments instead of this one, so that we can concentrate on the other interesting examples and not have to do that in order to program a little bit with Lua. So it's not an important assignment anymore. Good.